My name is Greg Jackson. I'm a PhD holding historian, a professor, and the creator of History That Doesn't Suck, a podcast that makes legit, seriously researched American history come to life through entertaining stories. Join me for a chronological telling of the United States story, from the Revolution to fractious Civil War, tenacious inventors, brave reformers, and more. With more than 100 episodes, you can already binge listen your way from 1776 to the early 20th century. Listen to History That Doesn't Suck on Spotify.
Hello, everyone. My name is Wesley Livesay from the History of the Second World War podcast. Join me on a journey through the most destructive conflict in human history, a journey that will take us not just through the famous campaigns and cataclysmic battles, but also to the lesser well-known corners of the war that touched millions all over the world, as we try and answer not just the questions of what and where, but how and why. You can find History of the Second World War on all major podcast platforms or at historyofthesecondworldwar.com.
Hello.
I'm Howard Dory.
I'm Jess Dory.
And welcome to Plotting Through the Presidents, where we take deep, irreverent dives into lesser-known stories from the early United States.
This is true. And it is me, but my voice sounds a tad different. 2 whole weeks ago, I had laryngitis, and I still sound a touch hoarse, so I apologize.
I like it. I'm getting used to it. It's the new you.
It's the new sexy me. Like, I sound like I should be quitting my day job and taking phone calls, but that's not happening.
Hey, you know, there's a new Patreon tier where...
No, yeah, there's not.
Today, I want to focus on an important part of the first president, George Washington's legacy. Specifically, the group that's done so much to fiercely preserve it, the Mount Vernon Ladies Association.
Oh.
This is the first in a series of 3 episodes focusing on different aspects of Mount Vernon.
What? 3 episodes?
I know. But don't worry, each one is its own contained story, so
okay.
You don't have to commit to anything.
Okay.
We can keep
you know
this as casual as you want.
Let's keep it cash.
Yeah. Yeah, ease into it.
Okay.
We, you and me, we had the pleasure of touring George Washington's home, Mount Vernon,
yes,
in Virginia.
It was a long time ago.
It was, and it was a great experience.
Yeah, it was.
I remember one of the most impressive things about Mount Vernon was the view. There was this vast, pristine view from Washington's piazza, looking out over the sprawling Potomac River and the rolling trees across the river as far as you could see.
I remember we sat on his... piazza. Is that
yes.
The piazza is a patio, correct?
Yeah, it's a piazza, it's all a right. Veranda, it's a porch. You're going to hear a lot of synonyms for that thing
okay.
In this episode.
Okay, good to know. I do remember sitting on the porch and rocking chairs looking out at that view.
Yes, yes.
And I could see how growing old there might feel.
Hey, there we go. I don't know if that's an option.
We'll see.
Maybe we, you know, move there, become members, and just go there every day and...
You know, they did have actors, reenactment
yeah,
actors.
Yeah.
We could sign up for that.
There we go.
And we could do our little scenes and then sit on the porch.
Yeah, I feel like someone would come up to us and be like, you guys are supposed to be doing tours, and you've been in those rocking chairs for 7 hours.
And I would say, we're growing old, leave us alone.
We're going to look at how the Mount Vernon Ladies Association saved Mount Vernon from ruin.
Wow.
And how their mission expanded immensely from preserving the mansion and the land around it to preserving everything you can see from Mount Vernon's back porch, which is a lot.
Mm-hmm.
It's a story of money and power and psychic powers.
Psychic powers.
Yes, and innovation. And in our next episode, an almost cartoonish villain who nearly turned George Washington's pristine view into a national disaster.
A cartoonish villain? Do you mean like Who Framed Roger Rabbit? That guy?
Yes. I want to say you're far off.
But I'm not.
But yeah. So this is a story today in 2 acts. Act 1, The Southern Matron. So George Washington... loved Mount Vernon.
Mm-hmm.
His home was truly his castle. It was a place where he could sit under his vine and fig tree doing the things that he loved, like building a world-class dung repository for his manure and bioengineering the American hound dog.
What?
These are the things George Washington loved
to do. I have so many questions.
I'm sure you do. Mount Vernon became his major occupation when he wasn't serving his country. It's where he wanted to be. It's what he wanted to focus on. And he once said, "No estate in United America is more pleasantly situated than this on one of the finest rivers in the world."
Well, that may be true, but did he truly do the labor of making his dung suppository?
Repository. Wow. Okay.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Repository.
No, I don't think he was doing the labor.
No. I don't think he was.
No. So dung repository is a different thing.
Than a suppository.
First of all, much bigger.
I would hope so.
Yeah. Anyway, we could talk about George Washington and manure for a long time, and maybe we will someday, but not today.
Okay.
So after serving as president for 8 years, George finally got to retire to Mount Vernon for good, to live there with Martha and his family. He didn't have any biological kids, but Martha did. There were plenty of grandchildren running around.
Cute.
And 300 enslaved people, too.
Oh, my gosh.
And constant guests. It was a working plantation and basically a bed and breakfast, and it was hopping.
Wow.
But George only got to enjoy this busy retired life for about 3 years before he died in 1799.
Well, at least he got a few years in.
He did. Martha died a couple years later. And then
after George?
Yeah. And then the estate stayed in the family for three more generations.
Wow. All slave owners.
Yes. Yes. Eventually ending up with George's great-grandnephew, John Augustine Washington III, in 1850. So that name, John Augustine Washington III, is a mouthful.
Yeah, so, it sure is.
So instead of John Augustine Washington III, I'm just going to call him Jaws III.
Jaws III?
Jaws III from here on out, yes.
Okay, Jaws III.
Yep, Jaws III. Okay. So by this time, Mount Vernon was falling apart. The overfarmed land, it wasn't producing enough money to keep everything up. Jaws III had resorted to cutting down trees and selling Washington walking sticks made from them.
Oh.
Yeah, there were people, basically tourists, that would come to see where Washington lived, and the only way he could make money was to kind of sell trinkets and things to them.
Sounds like today.
Yeah. Yeah,
exactly. Like as you go and there's a gift shop.
Yes, it was a little less organized back then, though.
Don't say.
And it was not enough to keep the place up. Anyone going down the Potomac River had a front row seat to the demise of this once great estate.
That's so sad.
Yes.
I'm saddened by this.
Eventually, one person going down that river as they passed Mount Vernon had an idea. Louisa Cunningham of South Carolina. She was originally from Virginia. Her family knew the Washingtons. As a child, she'd even been to Mount Vernon in its better days. Louisa wrote to her daughter. She wrote, "It was a lovely moonlit night that we went down the Potomac. I went on deck as the bell tolled, and we passed Mount Vernon. I was painfully distressed at the ruin and desolation of the home of Washington, and the thought passed through my mind. Why was it the women of his country did not try to keep it in repair if the men could not do it?"
Oh, man.
And Louisa's daughter, Ann Pamela Cunningham, took that idea and dedicated her life to it.
Wow.
Yeah.
She needed a purpose, I guess.
She did. She was 37 at the time. She'd been living with constant pain in her spine since she was 17 after a horseback riding accident.
Oh, God.
Yeah, she and her mother were previously consumed with working with doctors to treat her pain. So now she had something else to focus on. Cunningham took this idea of women saving Mount Vernon and turned it into a public plea. First published in the Charleston Mercury in December 1853, she signed it a Southern matron, which is interesting because she wasn't married and the definition of matron, I don't know, but women's names weren't commonly put into newspapers back then.
Mm-hmm.
She directed this plea specifically to the ladies of the South.
Oh.
She said she was moved by patriotism and a sense of national and above all of Southern honor.
Huh. Southern honor.
Yeah, she depended on the honor of Southern women because in her mind, no one else could be trusted. Not the North and definitely not Congress.
Huh.
So Northern industrialists, these evil, greedy people, they'd approached Jaws III and they'd offered him $300,000 to buy Mount Vernon.
That's a lot back then.
Yeah, probably to turn it into factories or who knows what. But he preferred to sell it to the government so it could be preserved. He was even willing to take $200,000 for that.
That's nice of him.
Right. But back then, the government wasn't really in the business of historical preservation.
Mm-hmm.
So the United States government and Virginia both said, no thanks, we're not interested in buying the property. To Anne Cunningham, that made Congress a useless entity that she couldn't trust.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't trust men because they haven't
apparently not.
They haven't gotten it done so far.
Yeah.
You can't trust Congress, and you definitely can't trust the North to take care of Mount Vernon. Because she said, schemes are now on foot for its purchase by Northern capital and its devotion to money-making purposes.
She seems a little paranoid, even though she's probably correct.
I mean, this is a persuasive essay, so okay. She's really hitting it hard here.
Right.
But I didn't realize just how much the original movement to save Mount Vernon was an appeal to the South to save it from the North.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah. To the idea that the ladies of the South would allow this to happen, she said, what? Such sacrilege, such desecration, while you have the hearts to feel the shame and the power to prevent it? Never. Forbid it, shades of the dead, that the pilgrims to the shrine of true patriotism should finally be forgotten and surrounded by blackening smoke and deafening machinery, where money, money, only money, ever enters the thought, and gold, only gold, moves the heart and nerves the arms.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
She's like a saleswoman. She reminds me of a Fox News anchor.
You know, there's that fire in there, yeah.
There's like some fire, yeah.
She was definitely using fear as an emotional appeal. That's interesting.
Yeah.
She really seems to hate the very idea of money. Right before she says, ladies of the South, can you be still with closed souls and purses? Right?
I cannot be still with a closed purse. No.
It's really hard.
I have to move in order to open my purse.
Yes. You know, the purse is the key to the soul, and I just open them together.
It's like fire and hate and fear and, you know, and give me money.
Yeah. She pleads to the mothers and daughters of the South to each send a dollar. Her rallying cry was heard and shared, and women started organizing groups in their states to collect money. But soon it became clear that this endeavor was not going to succeed with Southern money alone. They were going to need some of that evil Northern capital. Despite the fact that some Southerners believe Mount Vernon belonged to the South, and that any partnership with those nasty Northern abolitionists would be an unholy alliance.
Let me guess, they'd still collect their money.
Yes.
I'm sure.
Yes. Anne Cunningham expanded her original mission. She changed the group's name to the Mount Vernon Ladies Association of the Union, which is still the full name today.
Mm-hmm.
And state chapters were created across the country because, as Cunningham said, Washington belonged not alone to the women of the South. And in fact, coming together over saving Mount Vernon might just prevent the nation from fracturing.
Mm.
This was all in the lead up to the Civil War, so tensions were high.
Mm-hmm.
Money started pouring in.
Oh, wow. She was successful.
Rich folks were encouraged to donate even more than a lowly dollar. How much they donated was equated to the recorded estimate of their love of Washington.
Wow.
Do you really only love this man $100? Don't you want people to know you love him $1,000?
Oh, wow.
Bigger donations came in from Freemasons and from one man worth calling out. Edward Everett of Massachusetts. He was a former senator, secretary of state. He toured the country, giving a talk about George Washington 129 times. And those talks raised $69,000 out of the $200,000.
Oh, my gosh.
His big trivia claim, which I'm obligated to mention anytime his name is brought up, he gave a 2-hour speech at the dedication of the Soldiers National Cemetery in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania.
Mm.
But that speech was utterly forgotten because President Lincoln got up there next and gave the 2-minute Gettysburg Address, and that's all anyone talks about.
Oh my God, that's amazing.
Yes, he was a crowd warmer.
Poor guy.
Yeah. There were a lot of stops and starts and challenges along the way, and we're not going to cover all those here, because there are several great sources for this, including Mount Vernon's website and a book by one of the vice regents of Mount Vernon published in 1966 called Mount Vernon is Ours, with the subtitle of Mwahahaha.
I love how you don't want to cover it because it's out there already. I love how you want to focus your content on things that are harder to access. It's really cool.
Yeah, or more interesting to me. A lot of this is out there if you look, but I'm less worried about being thorough with every aspect of the history of how Mount Vernon was formed than looking at the stuff that I find interesting in order to kind of tell this story. Yeah. But it's worth noting that John Augustine Washington III, Jaws 3, he wasn't the easiest to deal with. He was dragged in the press.
Not easy to deal with. Like, did he have a bit of a bite? Did he have a bite on him?
A little bit. A little bit.
Did you see what I did there?
Yeah, yeah. Jaws 3 had a little bite. Jaws 3, not as good as the original Washington. Yeah.
Sorry, I'm not known for puns, and I thought I'd give it a shot.
I like it.
Thank you.
So he was dragged in the press for his role in wanting so much money for Mount Vernon and for selling these canes. He felt so slighted by what was going on that he publicly announced that Mount Vernon was no longer for sale.
What?
Which put a damper on the fundraising efforts.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So where did that money go then?
Well, long story short, Anne Pamela Cunningham personally appealed to him. She finally understood that it was because he felt slighted by the Virginia legislature and what was going on. And she just clarified that it wasn't the Mount Vernon Ladies Association that was saying bad stuff about him, that they had the same goals. And she just kind of smoothed things over. And
businesswoman.
Yes. So they sealed the deal in 1858. And in 1860, the Mount Vernon Ladies Association took possession of Mount Vernon.
Right. And where did Jaws 3 go?
Well,
during that time.
The next year, 1861, Jaws 3 was killed in the Battle of Cheat Mountain during the Civil War.
What?
He fought for the Confederacy. He'd been an aide-de-camp to General Robert E. Lee.
Mm-hmm.
So he was still dragged in the press by Northern newspapers at the time. They rejoiced in the news of his death, calling him a traitor and a disgrace to Washington's name.
Wow.
And hoping that his wretched bones would be buried as far as possible from George Washington's.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Southern newspapers called him a martyr and said his death was a great loss.
Of course.
Yeah. Which, I mean, whatever you think of him, Mount Vernon might not be around today if it weren't for his desire to see it go to someone who would protect it.
Mm-hmm.
And had Anne Pamela Cunningham not succeeded in her mission to save Washington's home when she did, the property might have gone to the next generation of Washingtons and been sold off to someone whose only thought was gold, only gold, and the blackening smoke.
Oh, God.
Yes.
It's dramatic.
Here's another podcast we think you're gonna love. It's called Subtitle, and it tells stories about languages and the people who speak them. In each episode, Subtitle will take you to a country or a comedy show or a research lab, wherever there's a story about words and language. If you've ever wondered things like, why do so many of us favor some accents over others? Or why do words like jiggly and puffball seem programmed to make us smile? Then Subtitle is the podcast for you. One recent episode that really piqued my interest looked at improv comedians, people who can come up with songs on the spot, and it looked at how MRIs were used to show how their brains literally work differently than most people's. Subtitle is produced in association with the Linguistic Society of America and is hosted by award-winning journalists Patrick Cox and Kavita Pillay. Listen at Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening to this.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. On our show, we help listeners like you make the most of your finances. I sit down with NerdWallet's team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. We answer your real-world money questions and break down the latest personal finance news. The nerds will give you the clarity you need by cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. We don't promote get-rich-quick schemes or hype unrealistic side hustles. Instead, we offer practical knowledge that you can apply in your everyday life. You'll learn about strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. And you'll walk away with the confidence you need to ensure that your money is always working as hard as you are. So turn to the nerds to answer your real-world money questions and get insights that can help you make the smartest financial decisions for your life. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
All you need is a few minutes to start your day off with something historic when you listen to the This Day in History podcast. Every day, there's a new episode for you to listen and learn about what happened that day way back when. Today could be the day a famous mobster met their end, or the first milestone for humans in space. Who knows what history today holds? Find out when you listen and subscribe to This Day in History wherever you get your podcasts. That's This Day in History wherever you get your podcasts.
And that brings us to Act Two, The African Queen.
Okay.
Fast forward 100 years.
That's hard to fathom. 100 years later.
100 years later.
So what are the main differences between the now and the then?
Well, it was the 1850s and now it's the 1950s. So people have TV and stuff. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. 1950s.
Yes. The Mount Vernon Ladies Association had turned Mount Vernon into a tourist destination and a museum dedicated to George Washington. They'd worked to restore the mansion to the way it was when Washington lived there, with some exceptions.
Nice.
They eventually allowed Thomas Edison to install electricity, which was a pretty controversial decision at the time.
Interesting.
What it came down to was deciding that even though it wasn't exactly authentic, it was safer for the place than kerosene lamps and candles.
Mm.
Yeah.
Safety first.
Mm-hmm. And during that time in the 1950s, Mount Vernon's mission expanded dramatically, and they turned their attention beyond the mansion and the grounds. Do you remember in The Lion King, when Mufasa and Simba are looking out from the mountain, and Mufasa says, "Everything the light touches is our kingdom. Mm-hmm. Everything you can see is ours."
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's not far off from how the Mount Vernon Ladies Association came to think about George Washington's view.
Okay.
What started as buying 200 acres to preserve his mansion and the tomb somehow shifted to include the mission of preserving everything you can see from the back porch of Mount Vernon, which covers 80 square miles.
That's a lot.
Yeah. To me, that is such an impressive feat of historical preservation. But how do you get the power to stand on a hill and point to everything down below? Which is, you know, it's the shoreline of Maryland. It's a separate state from where Mount Vernon is.
You're like, I don't want this to be touched. Okay.
Yeah. I want this to stay the same as it was 200 years ago. Forever.
That's powerful.
The answers to those questions start with a woman named Frances Payne Bolton.
So is she related somehow to Cunningham?
No. Frances Payne Bolton, she was the vice regent of the Mount Vernon Ladies Association.
Okay.
So there's not a family relation there.
Okay.
She's a part of the association. She was the vice regent for Ohio. And how the association is set up is that there are women from each state, mm-hmm. or most states, who are representing their state in the efforts to raise money and to run Mount Vernon.
Okay.
Well, she was that and so much more.
Okay.
Let me show you a picture of her just...
Oh, wow. She looks like a judge or something in this photo.
Like Judge Judy.
She looks like Judge Judy.
A little bit.
Is Judge Judy trying to be this woman?
She looks a little softer to me than Judge Judy, but I see it.
I mean, she's a little plumper, so she looks more huggable and cozy.
Yes, the huggable, cozy Frances Payne Bolton. She was born Frances Payne Bingham in 1885. Her grandfather was involved in the railroads and waterworks and real estate. Basically, every place that you could land in Monopoly was his.
Oh, my God. So he was doing rather well financially.
Yes, but not as well as her uncle, who was a partner of John D. Rockefeller's in the Standard Oil Company.
Oh.
He left her a huge trust fund. She was once considered the richest woman in America. And with that wealth came the ability to be true to her weird, wonderful self.
Good for her.
Yeah. And she married a man named Chester Castle Bolton, whose very name sounds expensive.
Yeah, every part of that name.
I know. He was a U.S. representative for their Ohio district for 10 years. And when he died in 1939, Frances was elected to take his place. She won by a bigger margin than he'd ever won by. And at 54 years old, she became the first woman sent to Congress from Ohio, and she served for 29 years.
Wow.
We're going to get to how she used her power and her money to help freeze time around Mount Vernon, because that's the focus of this episode. But first, I have to take some time to tell you why she might be your new favorite congressperson.
Okay.
You might start wondering, is this episode really just a love letter to an old, dead congresswoman?
It sounds like that's what it's going to be.
Who can say? Who can say?
I didn't realize you had a love affair with this person.
You know, I mean, well, first of all, Frances Payne Bolton, she was a Republican, but she was reelected over and over again by huge margins in a Democratic district because she bucked the party to vote for things like civil rights and voting rights. She was strongly against segregation. And
sounds like we need her around today.
there's less of that party bucking today, for sure.
Yeah.
She was against the dangerous Republican Senator Joseph McCarthy's communist paranoia.
Mm-hmm.
A columnist in 1946 described her politics like this. She knows that a conservative is not someone who merely says no in a loud, angry voice. A conservative must know how to conserve, which does not mean standing in the way of all change.
Wow.
Yeah.
She sounds perfect.
During the Spanish flu pandemic of 1918.
Last pandemic before COVID.
Yeah. Last big one, for sure.
Last big one.
Yeah. She and her newborn daughter both got very sick. Her daughter did not make it.
Oh, her newborn daughter.
Yeah.
So sad.
Bolton turned to yoga to help her recover.
Okay.
And that led her to Buddhism.
Okay.
She talked freely about her belief in reincarnation.
Mm-hmm.
Even though she was reportedly a Presbyterian,
mm-hmm.
she took life a la carte.
Yeah, I like that.
Yeah. She was also candid about how she didn't want to live after her daughter died. And after her son Charles broke his neck in a swimming accident that left him paralyzed.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
She's had it really rough.
She said that what kept her going is that she decided to try to make other people's lives better. And not just with money, but with education and leading by example.
I love her.
She said, "We're a so-called Christian nation, but we haven't practiced Christian ethics. If we had, there would be no slums."
Mm.
She was a huge advocate for nurses.
She would have liked OT.
She really would have. There's a nursing school named after her at Case Western Reserve University in Ohio. And she was behind the Bolton Act that created the U.S. Cadet Nurse Corps to fund the training of more than 125,000 nurses during World War II.
Mm.
She landed in Normandy just a few days after the troops.
Oh, wow.
Because she was very interested in how the wounded were being cared for.
That's really amazing.
Yeah.
It wasn't just from afar. It sounded like she wanted to be in it.
Oh, definitely. And this next part really made me think of you.
Okay. How so?
She loved to travel.
Oh.
She was the only congressperson who went on a 3-month-long trip that she helped fund, touring the African continent.
Wow.
She met with leaders, went to villages. She fled from an elephant and a jeep at one point.
It does sound like me.
And there's this one story. At one point, she met with the queen mother of what's now Rwanda. In the palace, the queen mother asked her through a translator, "Why have you come?" And Bolton told her that the official purposes, you know, learning about the parts of the world that her House subcommittee focused on and all that. But also, she said, "I have come these many miles because I believe it is important that women of opportunity and responsibility everywhere in the world should look into each other's faces and speak together. I believe that through such an approach to world problems, peace can be achieved."
Wow.
Yeah.
I agree with that.
So Bolton became a strong supporter of independence for African colonies.
Mm.
She saw to it that Congress created a State Department Bureau for African Affairs. This earned her the nickname in Congress of the African Queen.
Oh, wow.
A reference to the Katharine Hepburn movie. Mm. And I love the Katharine Hepburn comparison because Frances Payne Bolton and Kate, you know, what I call her Kate, they were both like born into wealth and they both did what they damn well pleased.
Mm-hmm. It's also called entitled.
Yes. Eccentric. But, when you're rich, it's eccentric.
Okay. Not yes. entitled.
Yes.
Depends what you do with it, I guess.
Yeah. To me, it's amusing as long as no one's getting hurt. And if people are being helped, even better.
Yeah. If you're helping others,
yeah.
then, you know, more power.
Exactly. She was the first female congressional delegate to the United Nations. And she was criticized for going to cocktail parties with foreign members during the Cold War. She was having none of that criticism.
Mm-hmm.
She said, "Our so-called civilized parties, where we mostly stand around on weary feet talking first to one and then to another, seem to be the one method we have to make the acquaintance of these many people who have come together from the four corners of the earth to try to lay foundation stones upon which someday there can be built the structure of peace." And somehow she always looked perfectly poised. Not a hair out of place, perfect posture. Another woman in the house once asked her, "How do you do it?" And Bolton said, "Well, you know, when you need to, you go to your office, you do whatever makes you feel good. You scream, you sing, whatever." And the woman asked her, "Well, what do you do?"
Okay.
And she said, "Well, I stand on my head." She was huge into yoga. And
well, that's awesome.
Years before it came popular, you know, into her 80s, I believe, she was standing on her head. It was one of her favorite things to do
inversions.
To clear her mind.
Yeah, that's great.
Yes. Being rich, she was allowed to do stuff like that and be open with her less than mainstream beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for example, she had a strong interest in the paranormal.
Ooh.
She funded paranormal research and parapsychology particularly, including with the folks who first used the flashcards that you see Bill Murray using in Ghostbusters to test psychic abilities. Those were real things, and Bolton was a big supporter of that kind of research.
Wow.
She became close friends with famed trance medium Eileen Garrett, who was a character herself. I don't know if you're familiar with anti-MAME.
Yeah, I've heard of it.
Eileen Garrett's secretary wrote the book Anti-MAME and based the character in part on her. So she's this huge personality. One of her frequent clients was Salvador Dali. So that's Eileen Garrett. Together in 1951, Bolton and Garrett founded the Parapsychology Foundation.
Wow, they're like a power couple.
They held research conferences, they published a magazine and books, and they funded research into stimuli transmitted to human beings by means other than sight, hearing, touch, taste, and smell. Just last year, the Parapsychology Foundation, they donated their massive library, a collection of more than 12,000 volumes on seances and hauntings and psychic phenomena and spirit photography to the library at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. So that's in their special collections now.
That's very cool.
And she helped put that together. And speaking of Maryland, let's get back to that Maryland shoreline across the Potomac from Mount Vernon.
Okay.
In the early 1950s, the resident director of Mount Vernon, Charles Seawall, he got wind that a big piece of that Maryland shore directly across from George's porch was up for sale, and an oil company was interested in buying the property to turn it into a massive petroleum storage farm.
No, that's terrible.
Yeah.
Sounds awful for anywhere.
So Charles Wall, he let Bolton know that this was possibly going to happen, and she was on the case.
Yeah, I bet.
Up until then, visitors to Mount Vernon, they didn't know how lucky they were to have that unspoiled view. Not because those woods across the way were empty, but because they were inhabited by folks like Alice Ferguson and her husband Henry. Alice was an artist. Henry was a geologist. They moved to a big farm across the Potomac in the 1920s. They loved that natural landscape so much, they wanted to preserve it. So they bought up a bunch of land and they sold it to their like-minded friends.
And this was unconnected to the efforts regarding Mount Vernon.
Correct. Totally.
Oh, nice. Yeah. Okay. That was lucky.
Yeah. They formed something called the Moyon Reserve, which is named after a Native American settlement that used to be there. A 1956 article in the Evening Star described those residents as the type of minor intellectuals vulgarly called eggheads.
What?
They like to live in the woods and are extremely concerned about any threat to the natural beauty of their ridge. You can't see their house from Mount Vernon, and that's the way it is always going to be.
See a correlation to Ralph Waldo Emerson a little bit.
Definitely, yeah. There was, I mean, they were, you know, related to this whole nature school of art and naturalist movement. And, but the land that was up for sale now didn't belong to the Moyon Reserve. In Bolton's words, a couple of Texans wanted to buy land across the Potomac from Mount Vernon. Well, I wasn't going to let that happen. So she bought the land herself.
Gosh.
485 acres.
Wow. What did that cost her?
I think it was something like $300,000 or...
Okay.
But it was part of inheritance, yeah. There's a poetry in that because her fortune came from the Standard Oil Company. And she used it to stop that same company from building an oil tank farm there.
Yeah. So it's a little irony.
Maybe a little irony.
A little irony?
Yeah, maybe a little oily irony.
A little irony?
Yeah. Bolton donated that land to create the Akakik Foundation. And she helped form an alliance between the Mount Vernon Ladies Association, the Alice Ferguson Foundation, the Moyon Association, all of these folks that would work together to preserve that landscape.
I was going to say, there's so many associations and foundations, someone has to form an alliance.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's, I'm glad probably someone's an alliance on needed. That.
And yes. I'm sure I'm leaving some folks out. The Piscataway tribe of Native Americans, I think, were also involved in these efforts. There were a lot of groups that agreed. And a lot of it was like, oh, yeah, it'd be nice if Mount Vernon had a great view. But a lot of it was like, we don't want this land turned into subdivisions.
We like
living the way that we live. And that all worked out for a few years until another threat to the view surfaced.
Oh, man.
The Washington Suburban Sanitary Commission wanted to build a sewage treatment center across from Mount Vernon.
Why would anyone want to do that?
Well, in their words, there's nothing there. Yeah. And also,
they were okay with destroying history. I mean, how much do they love Washington?
The Washington Suburban Sanitary Commission.
Right.
You want to know how much they loved Washington?
How much they love Washington.
They loved Washington so much that they said, look, what's the big deal? We'll build our sewage treatment center and we'll make it look like a replica of Mount Vernon.
Are you serious?
Yes.
That's bizarre.
Yeah. And that was their concession.
Can't be true.
That was what they offered. It was going to be a 3-story sewage treatment center. I mean, who would object to that, you know? Imagine you could take a river cruise past 2 Mount Vernons, one on each side. The captain might ask, can you tell which one is the real Mount Vernon? And you'd have to guess which one was hundreds of years old and the historic home of the father of his country, and which one was built in the 1960s to treat hundreds of thousands of people's bodily waste so it could be released into the river.
Oh, and I feel like the smokestacks would give it away.
Yeah, I don't know if there's smokestacks in a sewage treatment center.
Well, there's got to be some kind of industrial hint.
It's probably not pretty.
It's not. I can't imagine it looking like Mount Vernon.
I am not a sanitary engineer.
I think that was a lie. I think that was a lie. I do not believe them for one second.
Yeah, I don't know. But Mount Vernon was not going for that plan either.
Oh, good. Okay.
Yeah. But the Alliance of Landowners and Foundations, they couldn't stop this from happening. And Francis Payne Bolton's money alone couldn't solve the problem either.
What? What can't be solved with hundreds of thousands of dollars?
Well, the thing is, the Washington Suburban Sanitary Commission had the power of eminent domain. They could just take the land if they wanted it.
Why?
Because it was like a government agency.
Oh, that's good.
So if they deemed it necessary to build a sewage treatment center there to be able to treat the sewage of this huge growing population, they could do it.
But we're in the 50s. Like, there's got to be plenty of other land to choose from.
That's what everyone else was saying. So Frances Payne Bolton's money alone couldn't solve this problem. But maybe her power could. Mm-hmm. Because the only group that could supersede the eminent domain of the Washington Suburban Sanitary Commission was the federal government. So Frances Bolton's idea was to get Congress to intervene.
And it must have worked.
Well, if you remember Ann Pamela Cunningham,
mm-hmm.
her last address to the Mount Vernon Ladies Association
was that
she
Congress
died,
is evil.
Yeah, she told them never let Mount Vernon fall under the control of the government. Never.
Okay, but we're 100 years later now.
We are. And
things may have changed.
Yes. And Frances Bolton, as vice regent of the MVLA, she was working from inside the system to do their bidding. And she wasn't about to suggest that the U.S. take over Mount Vernon. But she wanted to pass a federal law protecting the land across the river, mm-hmm. as far as the eye could see, by making it a very unique national park.
Okay.
Unique in that most of it wouldn't even be owned by the government. Most of it would be private property, but the government would buy scenic easements from the landowners. And basically that means they're paying them to agree not to build anything that could be seen over the tree line,
mm-hmm.
not to use the land for certain kinds of businesses, basically paying them to lay low and not be seen. If they wanted to chop down a tree, they need the approval of the Secretary of the Interior.
Oh, goodness.
And these easements would be placed on the land forever. Nothing of this scale had ever been done before with easements, so this would be breaking new ground.
Okay. Bolton, I feel like I'm learning a lot about real estate.
Yeah, right? You know, we come to learn
about real estate and history.
Bolton had some high-up support for the plan. Like, she was friendly with President Kennedy and the First mm-hmm. Lady. They talked about the value of that view. In 1961, Jacqueline Kennedy had chosen Mount Vernon for a state dinner, mm-hmm. honoring the president of Pakistan and his daughter. And it was a huge event, and Frances Bolton was there.
Mm.
And an indisputable part of the charm of that scene was a pristine view.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure she was like, hey, you like that view, don't you?
Yeah, you can't really hold a party there with some kind of industrial plant across the way.
It would be a problem.
Yeah.
Yeah. But before that bill could get to Kennedy, it had to go through the House and the Senate. But her incredible perseverance helped that to happen. And in 1961, JFK signed the bill authorizing the National Park Service to acquire the land and scenic easements to make Piscataway Park happen.
Mm.
The problem was the law didn't appropriate the necessary funding, so it was pretty much useless. So for years, the park wallowed in development hell.
Okay.
Bolton was battling a Congress controlled by Democrats, locking horns with Secretary of the Interior Stuart Udall. Udall kept telling her that getting the funding for Piscataway Park was a priority. But year after year, nothing was done. Bolton wrote him a letter saying, I am afraid I come of fighting stock and would like to fight out in the open for what I believe to be right. And she reminded him that the clock was running out. Some of the agreements that the landowners made to donate these scenic easements to the park were set to expire if the park didn't happen within so many years. Eventually, she pushed through and Congress approved the funding to secure the park, and Piscataway Park was dedicated in 1968. 5,000 acres stretching over 6 miles.
Wow.
Yeah, the sewage treatment center, the oil tank farms would have to find another home. And I want to mention that the reason for the existence of that park is indisputably to preserve Mount Vernon's view. But since then, it's expanded to preserve the ecology. And more recently, the park has been working with the Piscataway tribe to tell the story of the Native Americans who lived there for 13,000 years.
Wow.
Now, it's so interesting to me that the Mount Vernon Ladies Association is a private nonprofit organization, and they're very proud of the fact that they don't accept any government funding. But their unspoiled view of the Maryland shoreline depended on the federal government's intervention and money. An unholy alliance. It's an example of the evolving compromise and collaboration in the spirit, I think, of Ann Pamela Cunningham. A partnership between the North and the South, between private companies and the federal government, using oil money to stop oil tanks, and working from within the government to get that land protected.
Seems like you need a few eccentric women to make cool things like this happen.
I think so.
Eccentric women with power and privilege.
Yes. I think about John Adams's Peace Field, which is part of the National Park Service, the Adams National Historical Park. And you can see like condos across the street from it. The National Park Service actually runs Adams's home, and it's in the middle of a town. The scenery is not protected. But Mount Vernon is like, we're super independent. The government doesn't do anything for us except bathe them in a beautiful bubble of trees. You know, it's just interesting. I think it should be noted.
It's been noted.
It has. Even today, you truly feel like you're back in time.
It does.
When you walk through the mansion or when you sit in one of those chairs like we did and look out over the Potomac.
Yeah, that was like amazing.
Even when you look up. Because the FAA declared Mount Vernon a no-fly zone.
Wow.
You don't mess with Mount Vernon.
It's amazing. Yeah, you feel like you're stepping back in time, definitely.
Yeah.
And that's what makes it a very special visit.
Absolutely. Saving that view was one of the things Frances Payne Bolton was most proud of, and she loved that place. In an interview looking back on her life, she said she remembers once sitting in George Washington's library at Mount Vernon when the moon was coming up. She said, it is the most beautiful sight in the world. And she said that a guard came up to her and said, ma'am, I know you have the same feeling that I do. General Washington is now seated behind his desk. And she says she looked, and believe me, she said, I thought I saw General Washington.
Oh my goodness.
Who can say?
Who can say? But I'm sure he saw that same view many a night.
Definitely. We are not quite done with the view from Mount Vernon yet.
Oh, okay.
Next time, we're going to talk about the shadowy place across the river that the light doesn't touch.
Okay, where the hyenas live?
Yes, and the character who owned it, someone who is begging for his own episode. We'll meet him next week, along with his maniacal efforts to turn Mount Vernon's view into a world-class honky-tonk.
Oh, wow. Sounds like a little bit of a shift.
A little bit. So thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening.
If you like what you heard, spread the word.
Yes. Now you know all sorts of real estate rules and stuff.
Yes. Yes. Reach out on Facebook or at plodpod.com to tell me if I got anything wrong about the complicated alliances that were required to put together Piscataway Park, or if I'm pronouncing it wrong. I looked up a lot of things on YouTube to see how other people said stuff. That still doesn't mean I did it right. This has been an Airwave Media podcast. Thank you for plodding along with us.
See you next time. We're growing old. Leave us alone.